Okay, welcome everyone. So what I'm hoping to do is, this week, we're going to explore the first Yom Ha'atzma'ut, how it was celebrated religiously and how that came to be. Next time, God willing, on Yom Ha'atzma'ut proper, my hope is for us to examine the Tefillah L'Shalom Hamdina, to look at the actual text of the Tefillah Avinu Shebashamayim, what we say, and those who are familiar with the tune, is a beautiful tune to it as well, and kind of look at where it comes from, who wrote it, how did it develop, what are its symbolisms, what's it all about. But for now, I want to imagine for a moment that we are of the generation who lived through the miracles of 1948, and now it comes and we're approaching the first anniversary of David Ben-Gurion's stirring announcement of the establishment of the State of Israel on Heyyar, May 14, 1948. And the first anniversary is coming up, and we are all members of the Knesset. And so as members of the Knesset, we have a responsibility to think about what that first Yom Ha'atzma'ut might incorporate, what it might include. Or better yet, we're members of the Chief Rabbinate Council. And we have to make a decision about what exactly it is that we're going to do and recommend for the wider religious public, secular public, as to what the first day of independence is going to look like. Even the name will be open for us to decide. Right, because Yom Ha'atzma'ut is a name that perhaps we take for granted now in 2017, but in 1949, no one knew what to call this day. It was very common at that point already. Over the course of the 20th century, there were many nations that had been founded, many began to celebrate their days of independence. But, of course, Israel, it was their first go-around. And the question of what to call the dates and all the fundamental questions were up in the air. And to add to that, there were a little bit of distractions, a few distractions that were going around, because the Milchemet Ha'atzma'ut, the war, was still ongoing. It lasted roughly 14 months until a final ceasefire. So 11, 12 months later, as we're leading up to the first Independence Day, there are a couple of other things that the Knesset is kind of focused on during this time. These hostilities are still ongoing. So there's a lot that this fledgling country has many blessings and a lot of responsibility and difficult quandaries and questions of all sorts that obviously are present at this time, economic challenges and all sorts of issues that are on the table, and yet the Knesset has to figure this out. So what I'd like to do today is to explore both initially we'll look at the Knesset's own response, almost from a secular perspective. The majority were secular Israelis, right? The labor Zionists, who were the founders of the state. Israel, in many ways, interesting. Israel, there's greater resentment against the Haredim and against religiosity in certain ways nowadays, but there's also much greater receptivity to spirituality, to religiosity in Israel today. There's actually been, many are probably familiar with this, there's been almost an awakening in Israel, spirituality. It's a really remarkable thing. It doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of tensions between the secular Israelis and the religious ones, the Haredi community in particular, but there's really a greater openness to religiosity and to spirituality nowadays. In 1949, the leading members of the Knesset were really not looking to grasp back onto religion. They were not looking to become religious people. These were people who believed that religious individuals, quite frankly, were responsible for, to some degree, quite frankly, for the fact that we had been butchered in the Holocaust and prior. And they believed that the religious individuals who focused just on prayer and other things but didn't take up arms, and many of the secular Israelis in the government blamed the religious Jews for much of what had happened, rightly or wrongly. That was the kind of attitude. So what did the Knesset, how did they approach this? Did they see it as a religious day? Did they see it as a purely secular day? That's one. And then I want to look at the chief rabbin in particular and see how they actually came to the tefillah, which is commonly recited today, and sort of the history of that and where that comes from. So the two pieces that
I looked to look at. Was there any representation of religious groups in Knesset at that time?
Not officially, but there were individuals in the Knesset who were religious. They were sort of the token Orthodox Jews, They were like they had like their go-to people. There's one guy, I don't know his first name, his last name was Nuruk. A guy named Nuruk, and he was a religious Zionist Jew, and they would always ask him, what would the religious community think? Oh, what is it? Find Nuruk, bring him in, let's ask him. Right, he's the liaison. So small number. Small amount of representation. Okay, if you take a look, what I gave you over here is a couple of things. We'll translate all in Hebrew. On page one, I gave you, first of all, a series of, this is taken from the Knesset's own website, and this is typed out transcription of some of the, or summary of some of the laws that the Knesset passed. If you take a look, the initial laws are the actual establishment of quote-unquote Yom Ha'atzmaut. So it says at the beginning, HaKnesset Machriza B'zeh, Ayom Hi B'Iyar, Kal Yom Ha'atzmaut Shiyuchag Midi Shana B'Shana, Kechag HaMedina. The Knesset announces with this proclamation that Hey B'Iyar will be called Yom Ha'atzmaut. This proclamation was initially sent out on the 13th day of Adar. So if we do our little Jewish calendar work, we're talking about, the year is 1949, I don't know the exact English corresponding date, but we're talking about springtime, around the time of Purim. In other words, one day before Purim in 1949. So about 9 months after the establishment of the state, and if you do your math on the calendar, it's about 50 or so days before the actual Yom Ha'atzmaut. So about 50 or so days before Yom Ha'atzmaut, the Knesset decides to make public that there's going to be some sort of celebration, some sort of day of national independence that will be declared at some point. They deliberate, they go back and forth. Believe it or not, there were politics back then, as there are now. And there's a lot of deliberation, and they don't firm up this plan, the date on which Yom Ha'atzmaut will be celebrated, as well as its title, until really officially the 12th of Nisan. So if we do our Jewish calendar work, we're talking about a month later after that initial proclamation, and just a few weeks ahead of the first Yom Ha'atzmaut. And the details have been left completely open. In fact, it's not until the 27th and 28th of Nisan, which are now the dates of Yom HaShoah, which is founded later, at this point, that wasn't on the table yet, but it wasn't until just a few days before the initial Yom Ha'atzmaut that Ben-Gurion makes any sort of declaration about anything being closed, about any of that stuff. That all is being done on the fly by Knesset, that again is very distracted, has a lot of responsibilities on its plate, and they're trying to kind of figure things out as they go. Ultimately, many of the post offices and governmental offices are closed. Many people, it seems, went to work on that first Yom Ha'atzmaut. It sounds like, for those who've spent time in Israel, sounds heretical. What do you mean? Everything's closed in Israel. It's a national day of celebration. But these things take time to develop. And it was still year one, and it was still early. So it's interesting how things went. You know, one of the things that's fascinating about the conversations in the Knesset at that time is that we actually have records of all the official minutes. If you go on the Knesset website and you have any interest, if you're comfortable with Hebrew, they have it. They haven't translated it to the best of my knowledge, but there are certain segments I would love to see translated into English, despite the seeming sacrilege in translating Knesset minutes. But they're just too good. You find literally they have all of the Knesset transcriptions of all the minutes from all the official meetings, to the best of my knowledge, from literally the very inception. Which is really incredible. So, for example, you can go and you can see the arguments about the way to observe Yom HaShoah. The initial suggestion to observe a day of mourning for the Holocaust, the debates about which day would be the proper suggestion, the secular Israelis wanted Yom HaShoah to take place on the 14th of Nisan, which is also known as Erev Pesach. What in the world?
Why did I
what? That's what, of course, Nuruk said, right? He said, look, guys, we got to talk. this is not going to happen. But that was the first date of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. Yes. The secular Israelis called it intentionally not just Yom HaShoah, V'Hagivura, because they wanted to focus on the physical heroism and not to maintain the image of Jews being led like sheep to the slaughter. So they insisted that it has to be in accordance with an uprising, and what more famous choice than the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. That didn't happen. The religious Zionists wanted it to be later on after Nisan, because Nisan is not a time of mourning, and the 27th of Nisan was actually a compromise, essentially, between Nuruk and the religious Zionists on the one hand, and the secular Zionists on the other, and that's very much. You see these conversations in the minutes, in the archives of the Knesset. It's absolutely fascinating to get a glimpse.
When was the Knesset started, actually?
The very beginning.
I mean, like the day after the vote?
I don't know the exact details, but I think they had...
I mean,
is a good question, but I think
immediately
they had...
Immediately after.
Yes, it started to be active immediately after. I believe that they had extensive conversations ahead of that. In other words, they had been planning, because the British had been planning. It was timed for the same day that the British actually left, right? Yeah. It was pulling out. It was the same day. So in advance of that date, there were extensive conversations around it. I don't know the exact details around it, but it was in place from the get-go. So you have that. So these are Knesset minutes. You take a look at the bottom of page one. You see it says, where it says 1949 on the left side there. You see that under Divrei HaKnesset. So it says April 12, 11 to 12. You see that? April. April. Or Yud Bet Yugimon Nisan, Tavshin Tet. So these are, in other words, we're talking about just 2 or 3 days before Pesach. Right? This is not much better than Erev Pesach at this point, right? I mean, this is a time of tremendous distraction, but there's a lot going on, and the Knesset needs to meet. So they do. And there are extensive conversations about, as you would expect, well, we're going to found a day of celebration for the new state. So, of course, we're going to argue, who has the right to establish this state? Is it the government that's in power? Is it the ruling coalition? Right? Is it going to be the entirety of the Knesset? And most important, should they designate a subcommittee to the subcommittee to the subcommittee to report back ultimately to the Knesset with the recommendations that they can completely reject the recommendations and send it back to the subcommittees? So these things are not new in Kol Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, and that's exactly how they go back and forth. Now there's this individual, I gave you just one small snippet, and we're going to leave just a few lines from the Hebrew here. This is by an individual from Matai, who is not in the ruling party, but was also he wasn't in Ben-Gurion's party, but he was a secular Zionist. Clearly, his last name is Levi. I don't know his first name, and he talks about this idea. He insists that it should not be determined, that the details of Yom HaTzmut should not be determined by the Knesset as a whole. By the ruling party, but rather by the Knesset as a whole. This is, of course, the argument of an opposition politician. It's what you would expect. It shouldn't only be in your domain, it should be in the domain of all of the Jewish people. But along the way, he does something that's not essential for his political position, and I think that's very striking and telling, giving the secular Zionist ethos of the government at that time. So you take a look at the second paragraph, and I apologize for the small text. It says like this, I'll read in English if it's too tough. Our translating English is too tough. He says, "Im anu rotzim shechag ze yechag amami." He says, if we desire that this holiday be a national day of celebration, he says, "Ein ha'inyan shayach la'memshala bilvad." As we said before, this is not limited to the government proper. Ela bi'ikar la'Knesset. Rather, primarily should belong to the entirety of the Knesset. Knesset Yisrael. The Jewish people, he asher machlita al hechag. She, the Jewish nation, is the one who should determine the details of this holiday. And then he says, achim anu chaverei haKnesset machlitim mibchina ikronit. If we make the fundamental decision, shehachag hu chag Yehudi. And this is just one example of the discussions, there are many, in which secular Israelis recommend that this be celebrated as a religious holiday, which I think is very striking. Shehachag hu chag Yehudi, that it is a Jewish holiday. Umitznahel, and is run or organized, lefi tchunot Yehudiyot, on the basis of Jewish characteristics. Uchefi she'anachnu regilim bechagim acherim, just as we are accustomed on other days. He says, therefore, we should give it to a Knesset committee that would determine the religious character of this holiday. So in other words, here you have a recommendation that was accepted by a secular Israeli politician insisting that not only should this not belong to the government in a limited sense, rather to the entirety of the Knesset, not just the ruling party, but also that it be determined as such on the basis of Jewish and religious precedent. And there seems to have been a sense that although they were in many ways anti-religious, there was a recognition, I think, of two things. That number one, that Jewish tradition, that secular Israelis also embraced some of the Jewish holidays, Pesach and right, Yom Kippur, such things, that there was a sense that even they were celebrating some of the Jewish holidays, and that if they wanted the entire nation to buy in, it was important for it to be, yes, somewhat secular, but religious as well. And so you have a movement, ironically, by secular Israeli politicians insisting that we give religious individuals some voice in these conversations, and that ultimately leads to the suggestion at one point that the chief rabbis of Israel at this time have a voice in these conversations in determining not just if the post offices or government offices are closed and how we wave the flags and so on and so forth, but more broadly, what should this look like? What does this look like in a Beit Knesset? What should the tefillot for Yom HaAtzmaut look like? How should we celebrate this stunning miracle and give proper thanksgiving to God as a Jewish nation while we need some religious leadership to be involved? Now, just to be clear, that doesn't mean that there weren't politics and so on and so forth. There was plenty of that. Of course there was that. Of course they were. It's the Knesset. Has anyone actually, you can actually go and see. I remember going and seeing a vote, a Knesset vote, and it was utter chaos. I mean, they had this like big countdown, 10, 9, 8, everyone's scrambling to get to their seats in time for the vote, and I was like, it's not just in 1953 that it looked like that, it was like that, you know, the 21st century, still today.
Are the rabbis on the chief rabbi, etc., are they all Zionists? Are they chosen from a group that are declared Zionists?
So now it's different than it was. And we're about to say, this is a perfect segue. The chief rabbis at this time are two. They already, from the inception, we have both an Ashkenazic and a Sephardic chief rabbi. You have on the Ashkenazic side, Rav Herzog, Rav Isaac Halevi Herzog. I'll give you a little bit of background in a moment. And on the Sephardic side, you have Rav Ben Sion Uziel. So Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel are the first chief rabbis of the state of Israel. Rav Kook, the elder Rav Kook, was the first chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine. He passes away in 1935. From 1921 to 1935, he's the chief rabbi of Palestine, but they're the first two chief rabbis of the state of Israel. At this time, the chief rabbinate is very much religious Zionist in the cast of Rav Kook. Rav Herzog, they're both very interesting people. Rav Herzog was born in Ireland. First-rate Torah scholar who developed a tremendous respect across the board in secular circles, in religious Zionist and Haredi and right-wing circles, Orthodox circles as well, respected his Torah scholarship. He also was a Torah umada, in other words, a Torah and science person. He was a scientist. He was a chemist by training. He earned his PhD in the forgotten field of porphyrology, which when I read this word for the first time,
I
think he may have invented the term. Porphyrology is the study of purple. Sounds more fancy than it is. But if you do a PhD, you can't call it the study of purple.
Yeah, right.
Study of porphyrology. Anyhow, Rav Herzog was at the forefront of studying the possibility of the renewal of the Tchelet.
Oh, And
there are different colors that are invoked by the Torah. There's the blue, there's the purple, the Arkaman, and determining the exact coloring of the Tchelet dye was a major matter of dispute. And ultimately, he wasn't involved in the newest discovery of the Tchelet, but he was very much involved in paving the way for that. So he was an incredibly broad individual who really brought together the best of science and the best of Torah in a remarkable kind of way. Rav Uziel was a traditional Sephardic posek, and traditional in the sense that his goal was to balance authenticity to halachic principles on the one hand, with a sense of inclusion of the Jewish community and the Sephardic community in particular. So those are familiar with the approach of Rav Ovadia Yosef. Rav Ovadia was not only a towering Torah scholar, but very much tried to incorporate as much of Ashkenazi community, maybe a little bit less so, you could argue, that's a separate conversation, but certainly the Sephardic community, it was very important for him to really include as much as possible and not to be unnecessarily stringent where it might be implausible or unrealistic for the wider Sephardic community. So Uziel was from a similar cast, and he actually studied conversion. He was one of the most lenient poskim on matters of conversion at that time, which is consistent with his larger philosophy as well. So they were the chief rabbis at this time, and they are consulted. Of course, they have their own complexities, their chief rabbis. They also have a chief rabbinate council with whom they have to consult in order to pass anything through. That, I think, was more of a mixed group, is my impression. I don't know all the names, but my impression is that the chief rabbinate council included more right-leaning or Haredi individuals and sort of was harder to build consensus around such a divisive issue as Yom HaTzmaut, which really split the more modern or religious Zionist community from the Haredi community, which was quite strongly opposed, as is well known, to any of these innovations, didn't believe in establishing a new day. Very famously, the Chazon Ish said that I daven on Yom HaTzmaut like the same way as Ben Gurion. I don't say Hallel and I don't say Tachana, we're the same. So that was the classic line.
Can I
interrupt? Yes.
You have several times you alluded to government as opposed to the entire Knesset. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand that differentiation.
So the way that the Knesset is structured is similar to European parliaments, in which you run as a party. And if you are able, the party that receives the most votes is able to build, if they're able to build a ruling coalition, yeah. Mm-hmm. So then the prime minister is chosen from the person on top of that list. So Ben Gurion's party, his Labor Zionist party, was chosen as they received the most votes and they were able to build the ruling coalition. So you have three groups. You have the actual party that was elected, then you have the other groups that sit on that coalition, and then you have the opposition. So you're a member of the larger Knesset, so this is 120 members, but you're not actually in the ruling party. And the dispute between the opposition parties and the ruling parties was whether this would be determined by the ruling government that was sitting in power at the time, or by the entirety of the Knesset, whether or not they were in the group that had formed the leadership government.
Some kind of consensus. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So that's essentially what we have in mind. Okay, so the question comes to the chief rabbis. And some of the information that I'm going to use actually is published. If you turn around for a moment, you'll see there's a white
nice
sidur over there. Okay, that, I can actually pass it around. Beth, do you want to grab it? Feel free. It is a relatively newly published machzor for Yom HaAtzmaut Yom Yerushalayim. Top left, that white one. Just watch out for the Korah and stuff. Don't worry about those. Thank you very much. Feel free to open it up and pass it around. I think it was published 2 years ago by Koren, Hebrew English, Yom HaAtzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim Machzor. Now you might ask, well, what takes up an entire book? That's a lot, you know, Yom Kippur I've seen, but this seems a little bit much. So the truth is, though, that they have all the tefillot and the different minhagim, and then about a third of the book, and they have a lot of commentary in the bottom, and about a third of the book starts from the English side and has a series of English language essays on themes for Yom HaAtzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim. Many of them are translated from Hebrew, so you have a flavor of Israeli religious Zionists, and many of them are great American or non-Israeli thinkers as well. Rabbi Moshe Taragin from Gush was highly instrumental in putting this together. Rabbi Benny Lau of Yerushalayim, was also here a number of years ago, was one of the primary contributors to this volume. And they have translations of essays from Rav Soloveitchik, from Rav Cook, and many, many, many others. Dr. Eric Wright, Rabbi Sachs has in there, Erica Brown, who was here a few years ago. She has a piece in here which I highly recommend, which is very interesting. There's one of the pieces that they translated is from a Rabbi Shmuel Katz. Turns out Rabbi Shmuel Katz, I was not previously familiar with the name of this Rabbi Katz. I have a cousin named Shmuel Katz, so I said, I didn't know he had tznicha, let me check. But it's Shmuel Katz, is, you know, could have been a Dov Schwartz. I mean, it's, you know, how many Shmuel Katzes are there in the world? So Rabbi Shmuel Katz, it turns out, this Rabbi Shmuel Katz is the chief researcher for the chief rabbinate's office. I didn't realize they had a researcher, but apparently they do. And he wrote an article on the basis of archival evidence that attempted to reconstruct these deliberations of the chief rabbinic office. These are available online. You can find them. I think they're on Amazon. I hope they're on Amazon. Otherwise, you can certainly find them on the Koren website and maybe do a rush job in the ordering. Hopefully get it in time for Yom HaAtzmaut. But I've been reading some of the essays the last couple of days, and I very much enjoyed them. It was a little awkward. I was walking around. I don't have a ton of reading time during the week, so Shabbos and Yontif are prime reading opportunities. So I'm walking around on the 7th and 8th days of Pesach with my Yom HaAtzmaut Masa, trying to shield people from the awkward looks that I knew I was going to get. So anyhow, so what I'm going to present actually is in part at least based on his presentation and his reconstruction. Okay, so to come back to the chief rabbis, you have an initial piece that is published on the 8th of Nisan. So we're talking about less than a month, maybe 4 weeks, less than 4 weeks prior to the first Yom HaTzmaut, but they're trying to get something done. The first piece that we're going to look at, it's a little confusing on the way they came on the source sheet, but now if you turn to page 3 of 10, on the bottom right it says 3 of 10. This is the initial translation from, I copied from his article in this book that's going around. This is, if you take a look at the first indented section, sorry, all the small type in this class, it says the fundamental turning point. So the fundamental turning point, this is an English translation of the first document that we have. This was sent by Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel to the council. So the chief rabbinic council. This is not published widely in all the Israeli newspapers at the time. So the chief rabbis write, the fundamental turning point in God's compassion on us, the declaration of our independence in the land which saved us and redeemed our souls, obligates us to uphold and keep this day on the 5th of Iyar, the day of the declaration of the State of Israel, for all generations, as a day of joy of the beginning of the redemption of all of Israel. What phrase do you see in there that's striking?
Rishit.
Yeah, okay. So this is very similar to what we say in Avinu Shabbat Shemayim for next week, right? In other words, this phrase of Rishit Smichat Geulatenu. By the way, we'll come to this next time, but there is an extensive literature as to the authorship of the Tefillah L'Shalom Hamdina. There were two major candidates whom scholars considered. It was done anonymously. But we have two primary candidates. One is Rav Herzog. And this makes sense, because here you have a very similar, essentially the same phrase, and if Rav Herzog is the primary author of the Tefillah L'Shalom Hamdina, Rishit Smichat Geulatenu, the beginning of the flowerings of redemption, very, very similar. Anyone know who the other candidate would have been? Very famous, maybe the most famous literary personality in Israel in the last 100 years.
Not Amichai?
Nope. He was a Zionist, but I don't know if they'd call him Israeli. He died too early. Won the Nobel Prize.
Oh, Agnon.
That's right. Okay, Shai Agnon. Okay, so I don't know if people have had the opportunity to read him. They translated him into English. We have downstairs, Koren has translated much of his writing into English. For those who are comfortable in the Hebrew, there's nothing like reading Agnon in the original. There's just no real replacement for it, but the English is worthwhile as well. So Agnon, there's new evidence about this. The current view is that Rav Herzog was the primary author, but he sent it for edits to Agnon. It was very interesting. Agnon was not an Orthodox Jew, but he was deeply traditional individual, understood our tradition from the inside out. I mean, he was a very profoundly religious individual, although he was not observant.
And eloquent.
And obviously, if you want a literary voice, you would send it to Agnon. So so this is Rav Herzog writing. This is the beginning of the redemption for all Israel. And to exempt the day of this great miracle from all customs of mourning of the Omer period. And to add thanksgiving prayers and sermons about this great event, get this, during the time of the Mincha prayer in synagogues. During the time of the Mincha prayer in synagogues. So we don't know what these prayers are. Tehillim, are we saying Hallel? We'll come to that a little bit later. Doesn't say, but to add something during the Mincha service. This means on the afternoon of Yom HaTzmaut. Yom HaZikaron doesn't exist yet, because we're still in the middle of the war. That comes within the next few years. Any suggestion? Why Mincha? We do things at night, in the morning, you would think. Say Hallel in the morning.
Well, Tisha B'Av.
What's with Mincha?
Mincha is like a turning point on Tisha B'Av.
Okay, good. But what would the turning point be here? This seems to be a celebratory day. Primarily, Tisha B'Av is a sad day, but it has a wrinkle, has a moment of consolation. Why Mincha?
That's supposed to be a special spiritual time anyway, you know, like
on Shabbat. On Shabbat, yes, but weekdays. That's, you know, bedtime, I don't know. Dinner time.
Most people are more available.
I think so. Right? Remember, the first Yom HaTzmaut looks very different than it does. It looks more similar to what we often experience here in America. It might be a work day with some extra things thrown in. People, it seems, went to work. I remember, what was the nature of people's parnasa back in, at that time in Israel, overwhelmingly.
Agriculture.
Right. This is right. They were out in their fields. Right, they're farming. You couldn't necessarily, you know, it's one thing to just close up the post office, right? You can't say that
which
to the plants.
Yeah.
What?
Which they do.
Which they do, not only on Yom HaAtzmaut, that's right. And Mincha time every day, they think there's siesta. Right, it doesn't say which part of Mincha time. So it could be the early afternoon siesta. But I think it actually means later on in the day, and I think it means when people get back from the field. You can't just go out to your crops and say, look, look guys, right? I need a day, right? This is my holiday. I'll see you tomorrow. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. Obviously, it doesn't work that way.
On television for I forget what, but it's a father said talking to the kid in the crib and saying, today's my day off. I'm leaving. And then the thing is, you can't do that if you're a parent. Here's some public safety thing.
Right.
It's the same.
Yeah. So, you know the one about the child who refused to get up in the morning. And so the parent comes to wake him up. It's time to get up for school. You got to get up. I can't get up. I don't want to go to school. I'm like, please, no. It's really time to get up. He's like, no, I can't. I can't face all of them, all the teachers. I just can't do it. Come on, you have to get up for school. What's going on? So he says, I really can't do it. He says, but you're the principal. And let me tell you. All right. True story. Very, very true in a profound way. Anyhow, so this statement from the chief rabbis they sent to the rabbinic council was considered by the council. We don't have a record of any response to it. We know that there were elements here. They were being very careful. It seems the dynamic is such that Rav Herzog and Rav Luzia wanted to see something more robust. The others were more hesitant, and there's a lot of them saying, what can we pull off? What can, because they're trying to navigate their own politics, what can we get them to kind of sign off on? Stuff like that. So this is the first shot in that series of negotiations. Then we have something very interesting. If you take a look at the next page, you have now a series of guidelines that the chief rabbis composed, but did not necessarily do anything with. So in other words, when Rabbi Katz is doing his research in the Knesset archives, he finds that in the Knesset archives, he finds this undated document. And says, I don't know exactly what to do with this. So he says, it says like this. This is much more robust, you'll see. So the recommendations they're thinking about are as follows. It says, one, ties also in the indented section. Tachanun is not to be said during Shacharit and Mincha. So no Tachanun. Right? There are to be no eulogies on this day. During the Mincha prayer before Ashrei, when the Ark is opened, this is like Yom HaZikaron before there was Yom HaZikaron, so it's incorporated. This is the prayer leader will recite a prayer for the fallen soldiers of the IDF. So it's a tefillah for Tzahal. After the repetition of the silent prayer, Hallel is to be recited without its blessings before and after. And the rabbi should give a special sermon in honor of the day. Okay, so a couple of interesting things here. You have Hallel, but Hallel with, right? Hallel, right? Hallel during Mincha, which is highly unusual, but I guess people weren't available, so it's good to work. And then it's Hallel without a bracha. There's a big debate that Rav Herzog and Rosie all think it should really be without a bracha. Did they say this because they thought this is the only way to get it past their council? Who knows? And then someone had the wisdom to recommend a sermon. So that's clearly a rabbi writing this. Unclear what the wisdom of that suggestion was, but that's what they propose. Then, interestingly enough, charity should be given as it is on Purim. Charity, tzedakah. That's really interesting, this idea of some sort of matanot le'avyonim, that as we celebrate, we recognize that not everyone is able to celebrate along with us, which is a profoundly Jewish idea, of course, on Purim in particular, but on all the holidays. You know, it's interesting. This, we'll see, it existed a little bit toward the beginning of Yom HaAtzma'ut, but it's not generally considered to be a central part of the celebration. I will say, I recently saw a Times of Israel post, which I happened to notice in this context, which the author suggested suggest that maybe we can go back to something like this. That maybe in addition to the celebrations of Yom Ha'atzmaut, giving something to Tzahal, giving something to Israeli families who are in need, might be a beautiful additional element in our celebration of Yom Ha'atzmaut. So it's not common, but it's a beautiful idea that's included here. Again, this document was never circulated, but this is the proposal. Check this one out. 4. The public should celebrate with festive meals, accompanied... Okay, fine. So that's easy, right? The only question is, why was that not number one? Maybe because it didn't need to be said, but once you're saying it. Okay, but check this. Accompanied by both zimirot, so songs of celebration, and sacred poems by poets, that is very beautiful, actually, such as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, between courses. So it's the great, and we'll see how that goes over in families with young children, but at least for adults, those who have seen Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the great Spanish poet who wrote so beautifully and longingly about his desire to move to Israel, his love for Israel, right? My heart is in the east, even as I'm trapped here in the west, in Spain. He famously makes aliyah toward the end of his life. According to, we actually now have new evidence that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi made it to Israel. Not only did he make it, but he lived in Yerushalayim for the last 6 months of his life.
Wow.
The legend has been that he was trampled by an Arab horseman as he entered the land of Israel, as he entered the city of Yerushalayim under the gates. That's a famous legend that's told. There's no real historical evidence for that. But in the Cairo Geniza, we have new documents that lend support to this. There's an author named Hillel Halkin, for those who have heard the name. He writes beautifully, gorgeous author. He wrote a beautiful biography of, it might be on my shelf, by Shakin Books. They're publishing a series of Jewish biographies.
It's on one of your shelves.
What? It's over there somewhere. You've seen it? Yeah, I think it's over there.
We used it before.
What? I used it a couple years ago when we did Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. That's right. So Hillel Halkin writes it couldn't be two years old because we probably did that 3 years. Within the last couple of years, in the last 5 years, Hillel Halkin published a new biography of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that incorporates all the evidence that we have from the Cairo Geniza. And he actually tells the story in that way, and it seems to be historically accurate. Anyhow, so we're going to tell we're going to read the poems of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi between courses, and a couple of options from the Psalms, including he has here the Hallelujahs. So we end what we say in Psukei Dizimah after Ashrei, those sections of Tehillim. And these meals that they conclude have the status of Seudot Mitzvah, meals that are a mitzvah in themselves. Now, what's interesting is that this document does not get sent around anywhere. Here's the document that goes to the wider Israeli public for the very first time. This is now the 12th of Nisan. So again, the first suggestion was the 8th of Nisan that's sent from the chief rabbis to the chief rabbinic council. This document we just looked at is undated. We don't know exactly when it was published. We don't know if anyone did anything with it, but the chief rabbis, it seems, wrote it. And then on the 11th of Nisan, so this is still one day before the Knesset publicizes anything official about this date to the wider Israeli public, a day before.
The opposition came out before the proclamation?
No. The opposition, you're going to see, was a result of a proclamation in the name of the chief rabbis that was published a day before anything was published for any of the Israeli public. So quoted in all the Israeli newspapers at the time was the next indent. Indent's section says state day, right? Yom HaMedina, I think, is the Hebrew, which is fascinating because, again, it was not yet universally known as Yom Ha'atzmaut. So the state day, the 5th of Iyar, which falls during the Omer period, again, this is reported in the name of the chief rabbis in the Israeli media at the time, which falls during the Omer period, during which certain customs of mourning are observed, will have the same status as Lag BaOmer. So I was alluding to earlier about Lag BaOmer. Same status as Lag BaOmer. And according to the decision of the chief rabbin and the 5th of Iyar, all celebrations, weddings, tried making a wedding in Israel on Yom Ha'atzmaut. It didn't really work, but okay. Weddings, haircuts, etc. are permitted. In Israel, in religious Zionist circles, it's not uncommon nowadays to get haircuts in Yom Ha'atzmaut. For Americans who grew up here in the community, it's quite unusual. But in Israel, it's actually quite common. So this was put out there. Now, the Haredi community reads the newspapers just like the general. They didn't have Yatzei Ne'eman yet, so they're reading the same newspapers that the rest of them are reading. And there's a real firestorm that erupts. The comparison between Yom Ha'atzmaut, this newfangled holiday, and Lag BaOmer, which is traditionally the end of the mourning period. Weddings, haircuts, you're just completely canceling the Omer. What do you mean? We have this long-standing tradition. We don't do these things until Lag BaOmer. And it erupted. The Aguda, which is the political arm, they complain about it, etc. There's a lot of back and forth. They claim that the chief rabbinate never really meant this. Okay, there's a lot of back and forth. And as a result of these conversations, the next document that we have is some 7 days later, is a week later, on the 18th of Nisan. So we're on Chol HaMoed Pesach. They managed to get their act together, and the chief rabbis publish after, this is after the conversations with their council, and this is the consensus that they come to on page 193. It says, one Tachanun is not to be recited on this day, two during the morning prayers now. So they move it. In other words, there was a practical argument for holding it in the afternoon, but it seems that it's more traditional to do, if you're going to do something, do it in, at Shacharit, do it in the morning. So let everyone get up early, and before they go out to the fields, before they go to work, what have you, let them say these tefillot. During the morning prayers, Hallel is to be recited without a blessing, they say. A memorial service is to be held for those who fell during the War of Independence, which was not yet complete, but is nearly a year into the war, and there had been many casualties, so those are included here as well. And a blessing is to be recited for the state. Is this Avinu Shabbat Shemayim, which had already been composed, but I don't know if it was universally recited in communities and shuls and the like, or something else, I'm not sure. It sounds like they're leaving it open. And of course, the meal festivities and song is to be held. And this to me is quite striking. Again, presents should be given to the poor, which this was publicized. So this is something that's interesting to think about. Maybe this should be something that's worth going back to. So here we have this sort of compromise view, which is put forward by the chief rabbis. Okay, that seemed to be the end of the story. You would have thought at that time, these are the recommendations, this is what you're going to do. Except that about 12 days later, there was a document that was sent to the press, leaked to the press, I don't know the exact story, with a much more robust treatment of the subject. Not just a few guidelines for the day, but an entirely new tefillah, a set of recommended prayers that could be recited, that ought to be recited on the day of Yom Ha'atzmaut. Those were published again 12 days after this document, on the 30th of Nisan. So that's, let's say, the first day of Rosh Chodesh, two-day Rosh Chodesh, about 5 days before for the first ever Yom Ha'atzmaut. And those look essentially, at least the nighttime ones, look like what you have in the other handout that I gave you. What you have in the other handout that I gave you is, this is what's published in the general Koren Sidurim. Emily, do you have it?
No. Got one handout.
Here.
Thank you.
This one there. Either way. And Maariv, for example, is completely different than your everyday Maariv. And this is published just 12 days after that previous one. So if you take a look at what we have published in the Koren Sidur now, and in many Israeli Sidurim, it's more or less the same there, although I didn't take it from this one. I actually took it, because this has more pages in it, so it's easier to copy from here. It actually is fascinating to compare. They're probably identical, you would imagine. But who knows? But you can follow in there also, for sure. If you take a look at Maariv, you can practice using it. There you go. If you want to order it. So the recommendation then, 5 days before Yom Ha'atzmaut, and what's been practiced with variations in many religious Zionist circles ever since, was to start with Mizmor Kuf Zayin, Tehillim Kuf Zayin, Hodu Lashem Kitov Kilelam Chasto, and this is a parak we do not generally recite, but it's about the ingathering of the exiles. If you look at the English, it's gorgeous. Very, very beautiful. It talks about the Jews who are spread all over the earth, and they survive famine, different calamities, illness, traveling over the desert by water as well, and they all come together to Israel, it seems to Israel, even though it's not explicit, it's pretty clear. It seems to describe horrors such as Yoshvei Choshech Vitzalnavet, people who are dwelling in darkness, which some understood to be an allusion to the Shoah as well. So this Mizmor has been read by some in Israel, by prominent Torah scholars, as essentially something that was written with Yom Ha'atzmaut in mind, or at the very least was strikingly appropriate to be recited on Yom Ha'atzmaut. I recommend, if there's anything you're going to look over before Yom Ha'atzmaut, I'm a big fan in general of trying to prepare for tefillot or simply to look them over to understand, because otherwise, in general, it's very hard to find meaning, especially before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and the like, without taking a few minutes, if we can find the time. So if you have a few moments to look something over, I'd recommend looking this over, or just spending a few minutes taking a look. It's quite beautiful, and it's very hard to find it to be meaningful without that preparation. We say it, and no one really knows what's going on. And then, what's really interesting is you have sections from Kabbalat Shabbat, from Tehillim. It's like we're saying parts of Kabbalat Shabbos. Take a look at the bottom of 9:13. Hashem alach tegel haaretz, and then you have Mizmor Shiul Hashem Shir Hadash, which you can sing in the Kabbalat Shabbat tune. And then, if you keep on going, following up on that, now on page 917, you have three of the nine stanzas from the Chadodi. Right, this is what we say at Kohelet. This is literally what we're going through, and many say it this way. Hitori etori lo tiboshi lo tikomi yamin usmol tifroti. Except instead of saying right the Kabbalat Shabbat conclusion, right? Instead we substitute Yom Zehayom Asa Hashem Nagila v'Nismachavo, which is taken from Halal. Because we're not welcoming the Shabbat Queen. We are celebrating this day of salvation. So you have this Shabbos element. Then you say Maariv in the Yom Tov tune. It's a little bit complex, and we can talk about that. I have some feelings about it. And then there's this sense that this is almost a messianic moment of Kabbalat Olmachut Shamayim, when we've been inspired to once again accept the yoke of heaven, to be inspired religiously by this transformative moment in Jewish history. And we say Shema Yisrael, like at the end of Yom Kippur, right, in that haunting tune. Shema Yisrael, right? And they open the Aron Kodesh at the end of Ne'ilah, at the end of Davening, Hashem Hu HaElokim, and we recite that. And that's in Korb. This is after Maariv. Sorry, right after the Chadodi, we say Maariv, and then we come to this. And then there's the Misha Asani Sim, which is taken actually from when we bench Rosh Chodesh on Shabbatot. That's where that section comes from. And if you go to 9:19, the last page of the Tzvilah, I gave you part of Shachar as well, so I gave you the end. You have, but for Maariv, the last page, you have the public recitation of two psukim from Parshat Be'ha'alotcha, which are about the establishment of the different holidays and about how you blow the shofar, which is exactly what we do. And then Lishana Haba'ab Yerushalayim Habnuya, and then we pray for the, use the term again, of the beginning of the redemption. So this is a very messianic text. So Herzog was a big believer, not that Mashiach is here in a full-fledged sense, obviously, but that this has the potential as the beginning of the flowerings of a messianic era.
Yeah. So this whole text was accepted by Rabbi Herzog, and
yeah, I
also
explain it in a
for
moment.
Sephardim as well, and it is the same for Sephardim.
It was generally accepted very similar in along very similar lines. There's another Sephardic text that was published a few years later that has some significant but relatively small differences. But there's a Sephardic rite, there's an Italian rite. Believe it or not, Italian Jews who were living in Israel got together with their rabbis and they wrote their own modification on this. It includes, I think, Shechianu. I think they wrote their Al-Hanisim, which they add into Shemona Esrei. So I don't know how many people still do this, but you have that as well. And the Bnei Akiva movement did something also a little bit different. That's separate from what the chief rabbis did here. And then you have Shir HaMala, which had been proposed by Rav Herzog as the national anthem, but was ultimately not accepted. Hatikva was accepted, of course, wow, instead. But one time a year, we go ahead, and this is often sung to the tune of Hatikva, Shir HaMalot, like that. It's very, very beautiful. And then, I guess, following the Minhag of Rabbi Levine, for those who are at the Lower Merion Synagogue in Shabbat morning, we say the Ani Mamen. If you know what I'm talking about, they always say, we now recite the Ani Mamen, which they got from Rabbi Levine, but that exists here in the Yom HaTzvah. I never heard it before until the community on Shabbat morning, but I know it's at the end of the Tzvilah here on Yom HaTzmud. I always wanted to ask him whether that's where he borrowed it from or something else. Then they added Haftorah. Some added a Kriyat HaTorah that the rabbinate didn't do. Some added Haftorah with Brachot. And the chief rabbinate went with a section of Haftorah, which is messianic in nature, from Yeshayahu, which Od Hayom B'yot Novamo, which is also read as the Haftorah of the last day of Pesach, and is often read in shuls on Matei Knesset during the morning of Yom HaTzmaud, including the Hallel, the following the Hallel, and all of that. So that's a quick overview, and hopefully that was worthwhile in its own right. But just to come back to our line of thought, right, as Paya was asking earlier, what happened here? Right? In other words, on the 18th of Nisan, we have the publication of a very small number of recommendations. And then 12 days later, 5 days before Yom HaTzvot, you have this! You've got a new tefillah, like a completely new day. What's going on? So the backstory seems to be as follows. There was a prominent student of Rav Kook who lived in a moshav called Kfar Haro'eh. Kfar Haro'eh, Haro'eh, a vision, which is actually named for Rav Avram Kook. Haro'eh, Harav Avraham HaKohen, for Rav Kook. The rabbi of the Moshav at the time in 1949 was Rav Moshe Tzvi, sorry, it was not the Rav of the Yeshiva, sorry, living, a prominent individual living in that Yeshiva at the time was named Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria was the founder of Yeshivot Bnei Akiva and was the head of the school of Yeshivot Bnei Akiva in Kfar Haro'eh. The Rav of the Moshav, of that Kfar, of the community, was Rav Shaul Yisraeli. Rav Shaul Yisraeli went on to be the founder and the head of Eretz Chemda, if anyone has heard of it. Eretz Chemda is a very prominent religious Zionist yeshiva in Israel that produces Dayanim and first-rate Talmidei Chachamim, and Rav Yisraeli was himself a first-rate Torah scholar who was incredibly knowledgeable, a brilliant man, and also a passionate religious Zionist. So, on the 18th of Nisan, Rav Neria reads the chief rabbi's recommendation, and he says, eh. He says, shvach. That's exactly what he says. Probably not in that word, although there's some Yiddish still going around. I don't know. Unlikely. Okay. And he says, I'm not satisfied with it. He says, you know, they were shackled by the chief rabbinate council, and they couldn't do what they wanted to do, what have you. He turns to Rav Shaili, he says, would you like to write a tefillah for Yom HaAtzmaut? So Rav Yisraeli says, sure, I'd be honored. Let's do it. So they sit down, and over those 12 days, or maybe they had been playing with it beforehand, I don't know the whole story, but bottom line is they compose something and they bring it to Rav Herzog. And they say, would you consider recommending this as tefillah for Yom HaAtzmaut? He says, if you don't want to recommend it as a tefillah for Yom HaAtzmaut, he says, at the very least, maybe you can recommend it as an option for Yom HaAtzmaut. So you can say, if anyone would like to adopt a tefillah chagigit for Yom HaAtzmaut, here's an option that the chief rabbinate puts forward. They brought it to Rav Herzog and Rav Lucia like that. And they said, sure. They said, sure.
To but Rav Herzog,
I think they initially did it as an option, I believe. But Rav Herzog had some edits. I think they included Shechianu. He took that out. I thought it was a little bit much. Maybe, I don't remember, sure. I think that there were some other suggestions, maybe a Kriyat HaTorah that he thought was a little bit much. So there were some edits around the edges, but the bulk of it they accepted, and they actually went ahead and published it exactly this fashion, and that became, sort of historically, the primary text that we often use that we use for Yom HaAtzmaut.
This was in time for the first Yom HaAtzmaut.
It was indeed in time. The whole thing was a rush job. We're talking about such a tight amount of time. From Bet Nisan or what have you, it's a matter of a few, Purim, and then, right, and then it's a very busy time in the Jewish calendar, never mind that it's a country at war.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a lot that are going on, and yet they somehow managed to get this together. Again, as I mentioned, there were some other tefillot, some of which went less far, you know, some of which went more far, and there's still, you know, further, there's no one unanimous minhag. I mean, it's relatively new, and different communities, even in Israel, do slightly different things and have different practices. And if you take a look at the machzor that went around, they indicate as such. They'll say, you know, there are different practices here. We're going to write it this way, but there are different minhagim that are out there. But that's a little bit about the story, sort of the backdrop to the composition of this first tefillah. In the end of the day, to my mind, while we get a sense of how complicated it was to operate in this environment, I think in the end of the day, I think the larger thrust is a very powerful one, a very beautiful one. First of all, the idea that the secular Israelis, or some at least prominent secular Israelis at the time, recognize that even from their perspective, that there's a certain depth, that there's a certain significance to our traditions, and the importance of introducing them even from a secular perspective into infusing our new spiritual holy days and days of Thanksgiving, I think is a very powerful lesson about the importance of tradition, about the power of our chagim in particular, to build community and to move us forward into the next generations and to grapple with new, very difficult and complex questions that arise. And number two, I think, despite all the disagreement, and there was major disagreement about the Hallel and about all these kinds of things and a new day and the Omer and all of this, but the idea that it was of critical importance as a nation to find some meaningful way to celebrate the Nisim v'Niflaot, the 3 years after the conclusion of the Shoah, at the end of World War II, that we were in a position to be composing a prayer of national independence, that the chief rabbis of Israel could work with secular Israelis to figure out what could this day look like, despite all of the politics that were there and the disagreements and the back and forth, the opportunity for us to be in that kind of position to give Shira to HaKadosh Baruch Hu from a very profoundly religious place, I think, to me, is one of the most stirring and remarkable stories, not only of the 20th century, not only of Jewish history, but in the history of human civilization. There are few stories that can begin to rival the extraordinary way in which we rose from the ashes like a phoenix over the course of the 20th century. And to me, this gives us a little bit of insight into the complexities and the opportunities of composing the tefillot, but ultimately, having looked at the tefillot and analyzing them together, hopefully we have new insight, new appreciation, and hopefully it can inspire us moving forward toward this Yom HaAtzmaut to join with together with them and to truly give thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the miracles that we have seen. It's a pleasure. I look forward to continuing next week on Yom HaAtzmaut proper, and we'll get to take a look at the actual tefillah from the United States.
And today, the mainstream Dati Lumi community does all of this, pretty much, as it.
More or less, yeah. This is, I think, this is the most common thing. If you go to a Bnei Akiva institution, you know, proper, they may do something a little bit more. They may say, first of all, they'll say halal with a in Bnei Akiva, yeah. They'll say halal with a bracha. We say halal with a bracha here. So Bnei Akiva, they say it with a bracha. Rav Goren Paskin that way, and others as well. And there's some other. They also have some other things that they say, but it's around this structure. I didn't have time to go through it, but if you want to take a look on your own, you can see on page 7 of 10 here, it actually gives you the first procession and prayer service of Yom HaAtzmaut, the very first year. And you can see, Rav Herzog was actually in America speaking. Rav Uziel was there. And you actually have the description of Rav Uziel decked out. And again, you could just imagine the chief rabbi wearing the traditional Sephardic regalia and reading the Torah, and Rav Goren, who was not the chief rabbi then, obviously, but was the first chief rabbi at Tzahal. Rav Goren was the founding chief rabbi at Tzahal. He served from 1948 to 1967 in that capacity, and then was promoted, elected to chief rabbi at that time, Ashkenazic chief rabbi. But he reads a prayer for Yom HaAtzmaut, and so it differs slightly from the initial tefillah, but it's the basic text that was used at that time as well. So,
would you say that cooperation between the secular and the rabbinate was for the rabbinate to lose after this moment?
I don't know. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think I don't know. I don't know the history of it in depth. I think that there was probably a closer working relationship. I would say, in general, the chief rabbinate had much stronger bona fides at that time, and quite frankly was just much more well-respected as an institution, and also was more religious Zionist. Mm-hmm. At this point, the chief rabbinate has, to a large degree, been co-opted through political means by the more Haredi community in Israel. And so the chief rabbinate is not clearly aligned with religious Zionism. It's much more complex than that now. But at that time, it was a strongly Cookian religious Zionist kind of institution, and so therefore they more greatly valued the importance of collaboration, of partnership with It was
population was probably
there hadn't been a Haredi boom. In other words, they didn't have a few generations.
The Haredi that we.
They were actually, well, I think in some ways they were equally, if not, I don't know if more extreme than in Israel, because the Haredi community is quite Haredi in Israel. No, it's very different than in America. In other words, in America, it's much more common to get some sort of education, to get a job. In Israel, it's much more common for the boys to just learn for, you know, the default almost is to learn for your entire life, and the women get educations, right, work, and raise the children. But that's another conversation, right? I don't know if it's more extreme now, but or less extreme now, but it's they were not interested in secular educations. But it was a smaller country that was more interwoven, and so the Haredim didn't just say, ah, they're religious Zionists, who cares what they do. It was a much more integrated community, and so they felt much more strongly about what happened in the religious Zionist community than today, which was more separate.
I'm just reading what you have what's copied at the end of page 7, which,
yeah.
I mean, the fact that they pulled this together so quickly in Israel, and yet in New York City, 200,000 people showed up for an event at Madison Square Garden.
I don't think that's accurate.
but it means obviously people here.
Do we have pictures?
What?
but obviously.
So I did this last night, and we had all the jokes about the inauguration. Yeah.
But we obviously even here had planning for it. So this wasn't something that was just done in 7 days. So
that's right. From Adar, they pulled something together, and they sent the big attraction was Rav Herzog, who was the keynote speaker. They split up because there were two chief rabbis. They kept Rav Uziel in Israel and actually sent Rav Herzog to New York for the first Yom HaTzmaut as an emissary of the state. So it seems that they had. I don't know if they did tefillah or what that looked like. I don't know if they have records of that. they needed every bit that they could get. That's for sure. I mean, times were quite dire economically for Israel. So that's for sure. Very good. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Excellent.